From the Sky News Centre at 5, David Cameron and Bank of England Governor Sir Mervyn King have both called for a real change in culture at British banks. Their comments follow a mis-selling scandal involving complex financial products and the rate-rigging affair uncovered at Barclays earlier in the week. Labour leader Ed Miliband's given his view.
If I were a shareholder in Barclays, I would be asking myself, well, obviously we need big change here. Who's going to be able to bring that change? Who's going to be able to restore confidence in Barclays? Who's going to be able to restore confidence in the system?
Meanwhile, the chief executive of Royal Bank of Scotland has become the latest banking boss to give up his bonus. Stephen Hester says it would be inappropriate to take the money after a computer glitch at the company's NatWest Bank. A major clean-up operation is underway in the Midlands and northern England after yesterday's flash flooding. Weeks of rain fell in just 2 hours, turning roads into rivers. Julian Assange is said to be in good spirits as he spends an 11th day in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The WikiLeaks founder is seeking political asylum as he fights extradition to Sweden. He refused to attend a police station this morning. U2 star Adam Clayton's former personal assistant has been found guilty of embezzling €2.8 million from him. Carol Hawkins was convicted on 181 counts of theft from the bassist's bank accounts. In tennis, Britain's Heather Watson is underway in her third round match at Wimbledon, live to Centre Court and our reporter Simon Owen.
And it's tough for Watson so far. She has lost the opening set 6-love to Poland's third seed Agnieszka Radwanska. This was always going to be a huge ask for Watson, though the 20-year-old tipped to have a big future ahead of her. She's getting huge cheers from the crowd every time she wins a point, but right now it's a tough tennis lesson. She trails 6-love, 1-love.
And England's cricketers have taken an Australian wicket in the first one-day international at Lords. The home side made 272 for 5. That's the latest. I'm Stuart Duggan.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
That's your train, darling.
I know, darling, but I can't go until I tell you something. If I don't, I shall go mad. Mad, I tell you.
What is it, darling? Oh, hold me close and tell me.
It's about Cine Features. They bring great independent films into your local area. One can have a pint while enjoying quality movies in a friendly, relaxed atmosphere.
It sounds wonderful, darling.
It is. It is. I do so love you, darling.
And I love you, my sweet.
Damn, I miss my train.
Cine Features UK, bringing cinema to you. It could be right up your street, literally. Check www.cinefeaturesuk.co.uk for details.
Learning Partnership West is a local authority-controlled community interest company looking to fill 32 new positions in Bristol and South Gloucestershire. The first 23 positions are for engagement workers, whose role will be to identify and develop opportunities for young people between 16 and 19 who are not in education, employment or at risk. Other positions include one disabilities lead professional, three specialist advisors, and five lead engagement workers, providing casework support and guidance to them. If you think this is for you and you'd like to apply for an application pack, please click lpw.org.uk/jobs or contact Denise Gwyther on Bristol 907-4411. Closing date for applications is the 30th of June 2012. Learning Partnership West are an equal opportunities employer and welcome applications from the BME community. Successful applicants will be subject to an enhanced CRB check.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol, welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Well, our report last week on private security firm G4S and their security failures in the training for the Olympics has gone viral online. Meanwhile, Channel 4 News' Simon Israel transmitted a report Monday this week saying all is well. And the only thing to worry about is peaceful protester Simon Moore. Well, that whilst Britain is under a terror alert readiness that makes an attack extremely likely, supposedly, and there will be a ring of steel around the Games and no troublemaker will be allowed to get anywhere near the place. Well, that's after the news at 6 o'clock. Martin Summers' usual roundup of world events too in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two weekend weather forecasts from the weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs around 16. Fairly wet on Saturday, with some sunny spells, sunnier on Sunday with some showers. Next week, highs up to 20 Celsius, wetter at the beginning of the week, slightly sunnier and warmer towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 7th and 8th of July, highs down a little bit to 16, again, sunny spells and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. First this week, though, the Lopresti report, and Masonic Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, said on this show back on Friday the 13th of March he would give me a copy of the 2012 Bristol Provincial Yearbook, as the Freemasons have nothing to hide. Well, this lists the membership of Bristol's 2,000 or so Freemasons in roughly 50 lodges, many of whom meet at the Bristol Masonic Hall at 31 Park Street. Well, 2 months on, still no Bristol Provincial Yearbook. So if anyone has access to the latest or a recent Bristol Provincial Yearbook, it's a little book, it's about half an inch thick, I suppose about 3 inches by 5 inches in size, I'd really appreciate a look at it. Probably best not to entrust it to the post or a third party. Just contact me by phone or email, and you can pass photocopies on that way. And apologies also for not having a politician to help us review this week's news. There are quite a few that for whatever reason don't want to come on the radio to talk, so I've done a little list of them so you can see if your councillor is one of those either whose answer phone doesn't work or who simply didn't want to come on. The Conservatives are as follows: Richard Eddy from Bishopsworth, Kevin Courtley, also from Bishopsworth, James Stevenson from Frome Vale, Alex Pearce from St George East, and former banker and councillor for Stoke Bishop, that's another Tory, John Gulland. Well, on to the new Lib Dems, and Jackie Norman from Brislington West doesn't want to do it. Bev Knott from Bishopston doesn't do media. Patrick Hassel from Hillfields, Pete Levy from Hawfield, and also Cheryl Ann, also from Hawfield. Also Sean Emmett from Locklees, Sylvia Townsend from Redland, and Mark Bailey from Windmill Hill, and Alf Havoc, also from Windmill Hill, don't appear to want to come on the radio. There are also 5 Labour councillors who are shy or otherwise uncommunicative, and they are Mike Langley from Brislington East, Jeff Lovell from Filwood, Chris Jackson from Filwood 2, Barry Clark from Hengrove, and Phil Hamby, who represents Hillfields Ward. Well, the rest of the 70, that's about 55 of them, have already been on and are certainly enthusiastic. We've got a couple more to come in the next few weeks. So I hope I can persuade some of them to come on over these coming few weeks too. So on to the business of the day. Helping us review this week's news is Somerset businessman Julian Parry. Hi, Julian. Welcome to Drive Time.
Well, hello to you all.
First of all, can I just ask you about your thoughts on the mayor? Because Bristol was the only city in the country out of about 6 that voted in May to decide that we wanted to have a mayor. And what are your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of that?
I think there's a mixed view on that. On the one hand, we know that South Gloucestershire has gone back to the old committee system, which at least had democratic credentials in that everybody was having a fair shout. Having reviewed North Somerset's move over to the executive system, I think that's been a disaster. South Gloucestershire have gone back. Okay, Bristol's going to try and find out how the mayoral system will work. I think that will much depend upon the character of the people who stand and who support them. Let's just hope that we don't end up with somebody like Mayor Daley from Chicago.
Okay, now we've got this week through the door has come the very professional looking picture of the front page of the Post with architect noses ahead in mayoral race, and George is the bookie's favourite. I mean, they have had George Ferguson is the merchant venturer architect, former president of REBA, who Royal Institute for British Architects, who's standing for mayor, and now he seems to have a lot of backing and also quite a professional PR operation behind his whole campaign. Of course, this does skew whoever's going to win towards the people with the professional PR campaign behind them and the money.
Well, as we know of the American Senate, they have the best that money can buy, and we've got the same in politics all across the world. It is a question that pounds equals power. It's the way they use that power and the way it benefits the community, which is the acid test. And of course, Bristol has had problems over recent years with hung parliaments, as it were, always fighting and getting nothing done. So I can see that there might be something of benefit to Bristol in this, although personally, I think it is a step further away from real democracy, which in the end has to be reimposed by reference to the rolling referendum, which is, of course, an entirely different subject.
Okay, but the real democracy, how can you have real democracy when you've got the three main political parties in Britain, none of whom are really democratic? In other words, the ordinary membership of those parties don't actually decide what the leadership's policies are.
Well, of course, we don't have democracy in this country. We've known that ever since Lord Hailsham, good old Quentin Hogg, gave the Dimbleby lecture many years ago and advised us all quite correctly that what we actually had was elective dictatorship. And, you know, we have seen where that has led us, particularly since 1997, where I think we've probably experienced one of the worst times of low democracy that Britain has seen in many, many decades.
Well, why do you sort of point to 1997 as the beginning of some downfall then?
Because of Tony Blair. You know my views on him. I just think that history will record him as the worst that there ever was, because he said one thing and did another.
Okay, now tell us a bit about your business, because it's ever so easy to just introduce you as a businessman. What is your business, and how did you come to be running it?
Well, basically, what we've done, we're an intellectual property company, and we have created the intellectual property that will solve the waste crisis by giving us once a week collection, recycle 98% of waste for value. I've pointed out that we can take £150 a year off council tax if councils care to build. But at the moment, we don't get much encouragement in this country, so we're talking to foreign governments. And it is just rather strange that in the last week, a very, very senior official in Malaysia has suggested to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and a major Bristol engineering company, as it turns out, Bristol-based engineering company, that really they ought to talk to us because they'd like to see our technology in Malaysia.
Okay, on to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. How are you, Martin?
Hello there.
This week we've had quite a bombshell, really, haven't we, from Barclays. Really, essentially, what seems to have been theft by the directors, or at least by the some operating within Barclays. Can you just explain to begin with, what is this LIBOR rate we keep hearing about? What is LIBOR?
Well, it's the rate which determines who can borrow from what within the financial markets. So it's a very important key rate which determines other rates. So therefore, of course, the determination of the LIBOR rate makes a great deal of difference to various players in the market. And the suggestion is, of course, that the LIBOR rate is created through talking to people in the markets about what the rate should be, and it's supposed to be separated from the trading arm of Barclays. And what's been happening is that the trading arm of Barclays have been influencing the people in Barclays who talk to the setters of the LIBOR rate to fix it in order to fix their trade.
But it sounds to me as if the expectation is that one person in Barclays is not going to talk to somebody else.
No, but the point is that this is the system that we have, and it may be the system which is at fault. Because basically it's an insider's game.
Well, what do you mean it may be? Of course it's a system. If you are saying that people in Barclays are not allowed to talk to each other,
that's a silly system. But the point is it's self-regulation, isn't it? You don't need outsiders to look into it. We're the experts on banking. We're Barclays. We advise the people who set the LIBOR rate what it should be, and we also profit from that rate. It's in fact a conflict of interest. And of course the whole banking system is riddled with conflict of interest. That's the problem. That's why we're in a mess. What's astonishing to me is that the FSA has finally decided to do something about it's like when Al Capone was done for tax evasion. The banks are in fact thieving on a huge scale from the whole of the society, and you just catch them out for one small thing and maybe you can unravel them from there. Don't forget that the implication of this, if it's not just Barclays and other banks have been involved in it, is that they're going to be fined, and of course that will undermine their bottom line, which pushes them closer to the brink.
Okay, so it's a fine of £60 million,
which is trivial,
plus a further £230 million in penalties from US regulators as well. How does that compare to the amount of extra money Barclays and their traders would have made by fixing the LIBOR rate?
No comparison at all. I've always said, the only deterrent for financial crime is custodial sentences. Fines are wasted because basically they just regard that as a cost of doing business. I mean, that fine is trivial, absolutely trivial in terms of the amount of money these people take.
I've noticed a comment also that RBS are in a similar bind and are expecting to have huge fines. This morning it's announced that 150 million is what they're expecting, but that they can't get the money back from the traders who personally profited, so it'll have to be paid by the shareholders. And of course 82% of Royal Bank of Scotland is now owned by the government. In other words, we, the taxpayers, are going to be the people paying the fines into our own system. And I agree with Martin, custodial sentences, the slam of the door is the only answer to keep these people in line.
Martin, professional pensions yesterday, in fact, no, sorry, today, is saying Barclays' record fine is just the tip of the iceberg. The FSA fined Barclays $60 million this week for significant failings in relation to LIBOR and Euribor, which sounds like a Euro version of LIBOR,
after it
attempted to profit from the settlement process. The fine was the largest ever, as we just heard, but Barclays qualified by a 30% discount on its UK penalty under the FSA's settlement discount scheme. I didn't know there was such a thing called the settlement discount scheme.
Wouldn't you like one when you get done for parking?
Yes, well, without the discount, the fine would have been $85 million. Barclays will likely have the lowest fine of all the banks under investigation. And this is Mr. Buxton, who manages the $2.5 billion Schroders UK Alpha Plus Fund and heads up the UK Equities Desk at Schroders. He says, "I'm pretty confident that in these situations where there's been a breach of regulation, the first bank that settles will be proven the one that identifies its own issues and has cooperated the most with the authorities in uncovering the breach."
Well, I mean, it just repeats what Julian's just been saying. These fines are not any kind of deterrent to the sort of people we're dealing with. Basically, they can factor that in. I mean, if you've made billions by cheating, if you find millions, it doesn't make any difference to you, does it? Especially, as Julian pointed out, if it's the shareholders who pay, who turn out to be the government anyway, which is what happens when people sue the NHS, of course. The NHS then pays them back, and it's actually the taxpayer that's paying the tax bill, paying for it all.
Anyway, there was an emergency appearance, if we can call it that, by the Chancellor George Osborne in the House of Commons yesterday. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
What further investigations are required into the activities at Barclays? What sanctions are available, and what questions must their chief executive answer? First, the FSA report is a shocking indictment of the culture at banks like Barclays in the run-up to the financial crisis. The email exchanges between derivative traders and the LIBOR submitters read like an epitaph to an age of irresponsibility. Through 2005, 2006 and early 2007, we see evidence of systematic greed at the expense of financial integrity and stability. And they knew what they were doing. Keep it a secret, one trader tells another in February 2007. If you breathe a word of this, I'm not telling you anything else. Yet no one at Barclays prevents them. And no one in the tripartite regulatory system knows anything about it. And the government of the day is literally clueless about what is going on.
That was the Chancellor George Osborne speaking in the House of Commons yesterday. Martin, what did you think of what he had to say there? Because he's saying shocking indictment, blah, blah, blah. But what's he actually going to do?
Well, I mean, I was listening to that thinking, gosh, I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm actually agreeing with George Osborne. But when he got to the end and he blamed it on the tripartite system of supervision, which is basically trying to blame it on the Labour government, I just thought that's a cheap shot. This has been going on ever since the deregulation of the financial markets in the 1980s, which wasn't in 1997. It was carried through by the elected dictatorship of Margaret Thatcher. And that, of course, is the root of a lot of our problems, which many Tories will never accept.
Well, Julian Parry, this is at least it's been a Conservative government that's actually stepped in and done something here, even if this did happen under Labour.
I think they've been forced to step in. I think that it's not a question that this was them coming clean because they thought there was their moral duty to do so. I think they've had no choice. But I think Martin is quite right. It all started with Big Bang, and whilst George Osborne calls it an age of irresponsibility, I think we should call it what it really is, which has been the age of the swindlers.
And is this just pure unbridled greed then? Is it just that simply that because no one is looking over their shoulder, they are able at places like Barclays to actually manipulate the situation so they can ultimately, what effectively is steal money?
I think that's just a symptom of what's been going on in so many different ways during this swindling age. But I think the real problem that goes to the very heart of government is that back in the 80s, and I can remember it, they told us that we were not going to have workers working in steel factories anymore, banging out metal products. We were going to have workers in little offices banging out financial projects, products. Now, the problem there is they decided to make money out of money instead of making living earnings out of creating real wealth. And I think that that is where the problem has come. The banking industry has got to be totally overhauled. They have got to separate the merchant banking functions from the high street functions. And the two other things I think they need to do is to abolish the bonus culture. And if you read Richard Heinberg's book, The End of Growth, in that he suggests that the time has come for us to outlaw the very concept of compound interest.
Martin, that's an interesting idea, but Martin, theft is already a crime.
And is
there any reason why the City of London Police or any other police force can't simply go in and arrest these people who've been fixing these LIBOR rates?
Well, there's two reasons. One is that it's very complicated to prove these kind of crimes.
Well, not when you've got emails like that.
But I mean, this is a relatively small scam compared to the major scams that go on. Basically, the banks are bankrupt. They shouldn't be trading at all. If there were other kinds of enterprises, they would by trading with when they know they were bankrupt, they would be breaking company law. But of course, since they're all breaking company law, and you have to say you're all breaking company law, you'd then have to arrest them all and say this is all wrong. You'd have to arrest the whole lot. Then the banking system would collapse, and then we'd be in trouble. But the banking system's going to collapse anyway because the banks are basically insolvent. What's going on is control fraud by the people in charge. They are basically leeching all the money out of the system. They are looting at the moment. This is just one of the little scams they've been caught on, but they've been looting all the way. Because in actual fact, these banks, if you look at their derivatives books, are actually bankrupt. There's two sets of books. There's the official set of books, which they pay tax on and all the rest of it. The other set of books, which includes all the derivative trades and all the rest of it, which is massively in the red and has been for a long time. But, of course, if we were to actually activate that and say, well, you've got to mark to market what you're holding on your derivatives books, then they'd all be bankrupt. Now, they are, in fact, bankrupt. And when they were semi-nationalised 4 years ago, we should have said at this point, right, we're going to wind you lot up. But we haven't. We've allowed them to carry on. And they are still carrying on. I notice here, next story here, millionaires defy the credit crunch as rich get richer. Now, that's what people out there really need to understand. The crisis is only for us. The people at the top are not having a crisis at all, which is why they're not really getting their finger out to solve it, because there's no reason to solve it from their point of view. They're doing quite nicely. Thank you very much.
The question arises, can it be solved?
Not anymore.
Or is it beyond saving?
But I mean, another one of the stories you've got this week, Martin, you have slightly jumped ahead there, but is the final announcement that the Icelandic bankers are to be jailed? We've got several bankers from Iceland who it's announced just the last week or so that they're going to jail.
Well, good for them.
I mean, isn't that surely that's the answer, Julian? You can't say there is no answer, because there is an answer. What you do is you jail fraudulent banksters. And the other thing is, you potentially, anyway, there's no reason why the government, the Treasury, can't step in, take over these banks for nothing if, as Martin said, they're insolvent, and start running them for the benefit of us rather than for the previous directors.
Well, that begs the question as to whether there will be the political will to for the government to step in and nationalise all the banks without compensation, at the same time arrest all their senior executives.
Why would you need to compensate anybody? If a bank is bust, you wouldn't need to compensate anybody.
Well, I would agree with you on that one wholeheartedly, but there will be a lot of people out there who will be yelling and screaming that they were having their shares taken off them unfairly. But what you're suggesting is perhaps the only answer, which is for the governments of the world to step in, nationalise all the banks, kick the bankers out who've wrecked the system out, and sling them in the Tower of London or wherever they wish, and start with a new system under completely new rules, which, as I've said, abolishes the bonus culture and has a serious look at what Heinberg has to say about the need to abolish the concept of compound interest.
But you can't actually surely abolish the bonus culture. You've got to allow an independent business to reward its executives and its managers in whichever way it wishes.
If you have just nationalised all the banks because they went bankrupt because they had a bonus bonus system that went wrong, then that argument no longer holds
good. I mean, that's never going to happen under a Conservative government, is it?
Well, it all depends whether, in fact, they all run out of money and that we've got riots in the streets and an emergency coalition government of natural interest has to be formed, which has to take enormously huge steps in new government to actually resolve a massive problem, which, at the end of the day, let us all not forget, is numbers on bits of paper. It actually isn't the major problem that's facing the world, which is resource poverty.
And I'd just like to say, people on the right of the Conservative Party are quite blasé about the idea of Greece leaving the euro. They see it as a kind of a natural thing for Greece to do. But if Greece leaves the euro, they will have to have exchange controls, they'll have to have a command economy, effectively, for quite a while. And they don't seem to follow the logic of that. So we're all going to leave the system. That means that we're not going to have this free movement of capital. There'll be exchange controls. You won't be able to take your money out of the country. I mean, you couldn't do that in Britain until 1979 without permission. You couldn't take more than £1,000 out of the country. Wow. That was all got rid of years ago. But in actual fact, that system worked very well from 1945 to 1979, didn't it?
Well, one of the little reports in the Mail last weekend says talks about how Prime Minister David Cameron's father moved his money offshore. The Prime Minister's late father, stockbroker Ian Cameron, was one of the first Britons to move their money overseas. After the Thatcher government made it legal to take large sums out of the country, Mr Cameron Sr. became chairman of Close International Asset Management, a fund based in Jersey, as well as being a shareholder of Blairmore Asset Management in Geneva and a director of Blairmore Holdings Incorporated in Panama City. Although he'd previously been estimated to be worth $10 million, Ian Cameron left $2.74 million in his will when he died in 2010, a sum which only covered assets in England and Wales, leaving the value of any offshore accounts out. The Prime Minister was left £300,000, with the late Mr Cameron's widow, Mary Fleur Cameron, receiving the bulk of the estate. Mr Cameron's father managed to reduce death duties by transferring ownership of his £2.5 million family home near Newbury, Berkshire, to his eldest son, Alex, who's 48 and a barrister, in July 2006, just before he died.
Well, this is what, I mean, if we can take the temperature down a bit, just politically, I think it was extremely unwise for David Cameron to bring up tax evasion as an issue for Liberal comedians, when in actual fact, he's the Liberal comedian, his father benefited from the Big Bang. What did he do? He set up offshore funding for his family, which has been going on for years and is exactly the root of the problem.
And let us not forget that some of that money was moved to Jersey, and the people in Jersey, the deputy chief officer, I believe, last week, was calling now for Jersey to leave the UK because it feels it's not getting a fair deal from the Treasury. So they've all fallen to fighting,
yes,
and the whole thing's coming apart.
Send in the
Royal
Navy, that's what I say. Okay. Falklands style.
Well, before that happened, earlier on today, Martin, the Royal Navy, I don't think it's quite been called for yet, but King Mervyn has made some pronouncements again today. Who is this chap who's the governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King? And so let's listen to what he had to say about this dreadful situation with theft going on, money being stolen and cheating going on the LIBOR markets, which was announced with the fine against Barclays yesterday.
It is time to do something about the banking system. I mean, we don't need an inquiry to know what we should be doing. There must be many people who work in the banking industry today who know that they are honest, hardworking, and feel that they've been let down by some of their colleagues and indeed their leaders. What I hope is that everyone now understands that something went very wrong with the UK banking industry and we need to put it right. That goes to both the question of culture in the banking industry and to the structure of the banking industry. From excessive levels of compensation to shoddy treatment of customers to a deceitful manipulation of one of the most important interest rates, and now this morning to news of yet another mis-selling scandal, we can see that we need a real change in the culture of the industry. And that will require two things. One is leadership of an unusually high order and changes to the structure of the industry. On the former, that's for another day and another place. But on the latter, the structure of the industry, the Financial Policy Committee has made clear its support for the Vickers Commission proposals, And I would hope that Parliament would legislate on that as soon as they feel able to do so. All of the vicar's proposals. That's what we need to do to change the structure of the industry to provide the right incentives. We don't need an inquiry to know that we need to legislate for vicars. We've had that in the Vicars Commission report. We can see what has gone wrong. The idea that the culture of investment banking is the same as the culture of basic banking, I've been arguing for several years, and I think it's very clear now that those two cultures are completely different and they need to be separated.
So this also Mervyn King mentioned this mis-selling scandal, another scandal this morning, another banking scandal. He's saying, Julian, ultimately we need a change in culture, but also a change to the structure. Would you agree with that?
Well, absolutely. And the structure I think that we need to look at is nationalisation of the banks for a time, which gives them the period they need in which to reset the rules, reset the whole economic system to zero. Because if they don't, it's going to reset itself to zero in an uncontrolled way, which is going to lead to social breakdown, which is not anything that anybody with any sense wants.
Well, Martin, that sounds a bit scary. Do you think it's possible there'll be some sort of social breakdown? And also, there is this point that really that you've talked about in the past as well, that look, banking is so key to our society. Effectively, it's like something like gas, water, electricity. It's a utility.
It is, and I think I'm afraid that all of this talk about what ought to have been done should, you know, it's, as the Irish would say, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here. The problem is that what's going to happen is it's going to break down in a catastrophic way. That is clearly where these politicians at this level, they've not educated the population about what's required. They're not ready to do it, and we will not do anything in time.
But Martin, nobody wants that, do they?
Nobody wants it, but all the serious people I read are suggesting we're looking towards a crash in the autumn. I mean, a real crash, not the messing around we've had so far.
And the other thing is, it begs the question, do the people who have allowed this to happen actually have the mindset? Do they have the intelligence? Do they have the training? Do they have the vision to be able to bring this thing to a soft landing, to a calm conclusion? Or why should we think, and why should the public think, that these people who've allowed this to happen actually have the intellectual wherewithal to deal with the subject properly from here on in? Maybe we need to rid ourselves of all of them and put in a completely new team that have got a completely new idea.
It was quite nice on Question Time last night to hear members of the panel and the audience all talking about the idea of the bankers threatening to leave, well, saying just go, you know, fine, we don't really want you around here. And also this Icelandic story
without the money, of course.
Yes, I suppose they could try and abscond.
They can go and be refugees on the other side of the world.
Pay a little visit to the vault before they got on the plane, I suppose. Let's try not to encourage that. The former Icelandic bank executives have been jailed for fraud. The former chairman and chief executive of the Icelandic Beer Savings Bank have each been sentenced to 4.5 years behind bars, being found guilty of fraud. The country's Supreme Court found that John Thorstein Johnson and Ragnar Zophanias Gudjonsson abused their positions of executives at BYR while granting an ISK, is Icelandic krona, 800 million, which is about 5 million euros, loan to Exeter Holdings. Just, that's an interesting name for a company, just somewhere around here maybe. Just as the Icelandic banking system was on the brink of collapse, Exeter then used the loan to buy Gudjonsson and Johnson's shares in the bank that they were directors of, before putting them up for sale as collateral guarantee for the loan. A ruling posted on the Supreme Court website said the sentences were harsh because of the magnitude of the offences was significant. We're also facing a election in Iceland in the next few weeks, Martin, too. Mm-hmm. So do we think that the veteran president Olafur Grimsson has won out, won the hearts and minds of the Icelandic people dealing with these bankers?
If you read the article, it suggests that he is going to win. One point I would make about Iceland is that they agreed that they would only compensate domestic savers in their banks. And in actual fact, lots of British savers, my old business advisor, for example, was one of them, were compensated by the British and Dutch governments, because the British and Dutch local authorities and so on had lots of money in Ice Bank, Landsbanki and Ice Save. Now, in actual fact, what the Icelanders have done there, very craftily and then very correctly from their point of view, is push the debt onto the British taxpayer. And in actual fact, the British government had to bail out the British the British account holders. Now, of course, the amount of money that Iceland owes is so small in relation to what Britain owes that we've hardly noticed, but in actual fact, we've taken over the debts of all of the British people who are holding money in those banks.
So, Julian, would you say it's fair to say there's lessons to be learned from over the North Sea in Iceland?
Oh, I think that that is good, but I understand their past Prime Minister was up to his neck in it as well. So there are questions there about, it's okay putting the bankers in jail, but how about putting a few of the politicians in jail who encouraged it, gave it sustenance, and allowed it to happen in the first place? Maybe there is a case for us going back and looking at their record, not only just in Iceland, but in the Tony Blair government as well.
And the David Cameron, of course, David Cameron's father. Perhaps we should have a look at their affairs and all the Tory cabinet. Let's have a look at all of their tax affairs and let's see if they were involved in any of them.
Well, Cameron hinted...
Because it might well be the case that they are all involved in the current government, never mind the past government.
At the time of the budget, Martin, Cameron hinted that there was going to be transparency amongst the financial affairs of the people who are members of the cabinet now. Yes, but that seems to have been forgotten about.
Yes, indeed. Which is why he was very silly to raise it as an issue the other day, wasn't he?
Okay,
what
fine.
A silly boy.
Julian, as a businessman who obviously from time to time has to go and knock on the door of a bank, what advice have you got for, I suppose, ordinary people now as to if they need to engage with the bank and the bank manager, can we trust them anymore?
Well, as you know, on another subject, there are huge questions I'm raising tonight about just how much we can trust the banking system and some of its more basic functions. Certainly, I think there is a major problem in the country today, and it's a cultural problem that has grown up where everybody has been thinking you make money out of money, when in fact we don't make anything, we don't create any wealth unless we go out to create wealth. Making money out of money is not creating wealth. It's very often the crafty who are making the money, making the wealth out of the other hard-working part of the society that creates the real, that the small amount of real wealth that there is. But one of the other things that people starting businesses today have to worry about is the huge amount of legislation that's went out there. I went to a conference only yesterday on the insurance aspects of cybercrime, mind-boggling stuff. And you've got to ask yourself, do you even want to bother? Because every time you want to start a business in this country, you are suddenly confronted with a bureaucrat who's got a small hoop in one hand and a very large bill in the other.
But that's crazy, surely, because we're saying with the banking system there was not enough red tape, but everywhere else there's far too much of it. That seems to be what you're saying.
Well, of course, this was deliberate, wasn't it? Because if you remember and go back over the years, we'd hear the Environment Agency beating down on people here. You'd hear that oh, there were always rotten teachers had to be thrown out. I think they threw out a fine bunch of teachers who'd known a Liberal agent. I think it was deliberate. They've also want to bring in health and safety at every level. And yet, and if you're producing anything toxic in industry, my goodness, you do 10 years in the slammer. But if you produce something toxic in the banking sector, well, that's perfectly all right. Oh, look, we just got caught. The hypocrisy of it is just mind-boggling, and it's about time society woke up to the fact that it's not just the bankers, it's our leadership as well, the whole political system. It needs to go, and we need something else in its place, and I have suggested the rolling referendum to the leaders of UKIP, and hopefully that will see the light of day before too much
this
longer.
Is your proposal to have every individual be able to swap whenever they wanted to their political funding allegiance from one party to another, or one individual to another, a small group, a large group. So we'll talk about that after 6 o'clock news at some point, Julian. But we're joined now by Marina Morris. Marina, you've been looking at the number of applications to take children from their families, which have hit a new record.
Hello, yes. Kavkaz, the Children and Family Court Advisory and Support Service, received 972 applications to take children into care in May. Since April 2008, when details of Baby P, Peter Connolly case, started to become public, and May 2012, the number has almost trebled. The official message coming from social workers is that they are becoming less tolerant of poor parenting, perhaps. But were social workers really so cavalier in the best interest of children just 4 years ago? Or have social workers become so risk-averse that instead they have removed many thousands of children from their homes to avoid the blame for the next case like Baby P? One application may relate to more than one child, so these statistics give only an inference of the scale of the issue. About a quarter of these children removed from their parents' care will end up in secure units, children's homes, hostels, and special schools. But according to Shelter, when they leave social care after 18, they are more likely than the general population to become homeless. They also more likely to end up in prison. The remaining 75% of these children will go to foster homes. However, a governmental review published by Department for Education seeking to improve fostering services reveals major issues as the profile of existing foster carers ages this many approaching retirement. There are insufficient foster carers to meet the demand, and the demand continues to grow. A growth industry in recession. The response to this issue looks likely to include enabling people to foster children part-time, but does not seem to mention the effect on children of this pass-the-puzzle approach. The procedure for accessing potential new foster parents looks likely to be relaxed, and apparently social workers funded by cash-strapped counselors are to provide more support to foster carers. The government claims to be consulting widely these people involved in the process of removing children. Its list of those consulted seems to exclude parents fighting against the system to restore their families. Meanwhile, the issues and presumably the cost continue to grow. If the problem is poor parenting, should we treat it the cause, not the symptoms, by the Putin family? And how should we balance the harm done by the parents to their children against the harm done by the states demolishing families in difficulty?
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Julian, this is a difficult one, isn't it? Because it's very difficult to actually discuss a lot of this because of the whole need for confidentiality with these kind of domestic issues. What are your thoughts about this some of these rather shocking statistics?
It's not just about the children, it's about the old folk as well. And last year there was a case of Neary and Hillingdon Borough Council where young Stephen Neary was taken into care and deprived of his liberty when his father wanted to take him home. And the High Court, the Court of Protection, made it very clear that to do it the way they did it was actually an abuse of the 2005 Mental Capacity Act. My own family is involved in that in a way with my own mother, who was got seized and taken into care when there was absolutely no need for it. And then when my brother came along and wanted to apply to Controller Affairs from America, would you believe, the court lost all the papers and all the submissions I've made and refused to reopen the case. I've asked John Penrose, the local Conservative member, to actually take the matter to Ken Clark, that the complaint about the performance of the court, from which I've had four apologies, is conducted and a review carried out, and John Penrose cannot find the time to do it. So please don't vote for him at the next election.
Martin, the issue here really, though, is looking at children being taken into care and the fact that the whole process is, isn't it by necessity, it has to be very secretive.
Well, it's very hard to talk about because each case is particular and we can generalise about it as much as we like. But when the Baby P case took place, I remember a Labour woman MP, whose name I've sadly forgotten, stood up and made a very important point. And she said that 250 children in Britain every year are murdered by their carers. Murdered by their carers. So just think about those that are being abused. Of those, only something like 60 were known to social services. So there's a massive problem out there which social services aren't even touching. And of course, what we're really looking at is the social breakdown which comes about when people lack work, when they lack structure in their lives, and so on. I mean, people used to have a rather boring life where they did what their parents did and it was all nice and laid out for them. My heart goes out to young people in Britain today, especially those from care, because of course David Cameron is now talking about withdrawing housing benefits from under 25s. And of course, he's saying they should live with their parents. Really, they should live with their parents. Yes, like you did when you were at Eton.
Okay, so, but ultimately, Martin, my point was really more to do with the secrecy of the courts, because how can we have confidence that the decisions being made here in the courts, in the family courts, about custody of children are just, when justice isn't actually seen to be done?
It's very hard to do. It's a very tricky area. And I used to know friends of mine who worked in childcare social work, and whatever decisions they made, they were wrong. And it's a very, I mean, children suffering, whether they're in a family situation or taken into care, people should be actually concerned about those children more than they are.
Let's go back to Hillingdon Borough Council and Stephen Neary case. In that case, which was part funded by the media, the doors of the Court of Protection were blown off as far as publicity was concerned, and the whole procedure was made much more transparent and much more available for public comment. So there has been a change in the last 12 months. I'm not fully aware of the actual detail of that, but I know that moves have been made. Might be as good to have an expert come on to talk about that.
Okay, now on to our next story. Martin, you kind of hinted at it there, didn't you? Which is David Cameron's threat, I suppose you would call it, to withdraw housing benefit from the under-25s, saying that it's just simply not fair for young people, or anybody really, to be claiming benefits, to be actually getting more money in through the door than those people who are in work.
Well, what you have to do then is raise the living wage, and raise the minimum wage, and also, of course, provide some social housing. We haven't provided any social housing for people at the bottom of the pile in this country for a generation. We didn't do it under the previous Conservative governments, and we haven't done it since 1997 under Labour governments.
But we can't do that, Martin, all the time. We're paying back the debts that we
have. No, because what we need to do is reflate the economy, and an obvious place to start is by providing social housing, not development housing, social housing. So these kids leaving care have got somewhere to go.
There's a lot of truth in that. But you talked just now about we can't afford to do anything because we've got to pay back all these debts. Pay back debts to whom? The bankers who printed the money, like Ben Bernanke, whose printing figures will make your hair curl when you see this. I've seen the figures and the graph. As soon as he came in, the dollar printing presses went mad. The money went into Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, all the rest of it, and has gone out from there. And for every dollar bill that they printed, everybody else out here is supposed to pay real interest out of the Commonwealth on it. That is where the problem lies. Thomas Jefferson saw it in 1802 when he said, "I believe our liberties have more to fear from banking institutions than they do from standing armies." In 1913, after he'd signed the Federal Reserve Act into law, President Woodrow Wilson said, "I am an unhappy man, I have ruined my country, I have its system of production is now subject to its system of credit, now in the hands of private bankers." And when we talk about the need for banking reform, renationalisation of the Federal Reserve and a complete new look at the way that money is produced has got to be part of that solution.
But in the meantime, the under-25s are being told, "You're not going to get any housing benefit, you've just simply got to live with your parents."
Yeah, that's absolutely right, they are being told that. At the same time, they're told out and get a job, when I think it is a third of the students who are coming out of university with very expensive degrees now find themselves saddled with menial jobs because there aren't the jobs to do. The whole thing has gone wrong. When Tony Blair was out there speaking to those young people saying, "Education, education, education," what he should have been saying, because of the smirk behind his hand, was debt, 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 as he sought a new way that the New World Order could actually pillage the wealth creation capacity of future generations. And it is high time the whole of the world realised what has been going on, realised that a lot of the wars that have been created are there to fund this sick system put in by the New World Order, and we turned on it lock, stock and barrel, and a good place to start would be by creating new banking systems and then investing real wealth in the reconstruction of society, as one mayor in Chicago is now talking about rebuilding the roads, rebuilding the railways. And he's absolutely right. That's where the effort has got to go. Franklin D. Roosevelt did the same thing on the New Deal. We've got to start rebuilding the infrastructure of our society, not squandering money fistful after fistful by handing it back to bankers whose only asset to the or only contribution to society is to have a printing press in the basement.
Okay, hang on a minute though. You're talking about this whole thing, the New World Order doing this, the New World Order doing that. Who are these so-called New World Order then?
Well, there are a number of them. That let's not forget that it was Tony Blair who announced the New World Order. Gordon Brown has referred to it as well, and it is generally thought to centre around the old banking families and be centred in the United States of America. That is the thing that we've all got to look into, we've got to expose, and start to look at the sensible thing is, we're paying back all these debts to whom and why? What work did they do to earn the money to lend in the first place? They didn't. They printed it.
Martin, I mean, it isn't surprising, is it, when Julian comes up with expressions like the New World Order, when we're looking at the existing political situation and the voting system, and people are wondering, well, it doesn't look as if that is really where it's at. The decisions are being made elsewhere.
Well, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck and flies like a duck, it is a duck. Now, it doesn't matter whether we call it the New World Order or the bourgeoisie. It's basically the power brokers, and they've always been there, and they've always been pushing to get more power than they deserved. Look at the history books. The only thing that's ever kept them in check is the resistance of the people.
And in what would you say is the resistance of the people now? Okay, there's criticism of the banking system, but basically the bankers, the people who control our money system, haven't they got us by the short and curlies?
Well, I think what's going to happen, my honest appreciation of the situation, is it's too far gone for reform. The chance for reform was in 2008 when the system wobbled, and it's been fluffed. So we're now going to have a crisis which could easily end in a world war, and at the other end of the world war, maybe we'll get some welfare state back. Let's hope so.
One of the things that is a sort of part of all of this, when we mentioned last week, was this quite shocking pronouncement from the boss of G4S, the private security firm, that within 5 years Britain's police forces would be privatised. Privatisation has been a big part of this. It's been basically, over the years, it's been energy being privatised, there's been telecoms privatised, there's been water privatised, again and again and again. And one of the things is rail privatisation. Now, I know, Julian, that you use the train quite a bit. What would you say has been the result of the privatisation of the railways? Has that been a success or not now, we're whatever, 15, nearly 20 years down the line?
Well, I think the times when I use it, it's quite cheap and it's quite useful and I don't have too much problems. But I am not a commuter going into London at stress times, and I think for them it's a very different experience. But to come back to why are these things being sold off, you had a correspondent in here the other day talking about the way they're trying to sell off the National Health Service. And his point was, and I think he's right, is that there are certain people who have accumulated so much money in this world, not that they earned it, they accumulated it, they now want to put it in, to invest it in something where they can get a justifiable return, and they see state assets and state services as the next target. So let's go and buy them all out, let's buy the police out, let's buy the prisons out, we'll be buying the army out next. As long as we can make money out of it, it doesn't matter where we invest our money and how much we take over what previous generations have paid out in cash and hard work, toil, sweat and blood to create. Oh no, they come along, we tell Sid about it, we have a few shillings in shares where they're so say given to everybody, but in the end they'll all end up with the good old boys. They know that. And that's why we're in the situation we are today. It's all about making money out of money instead of creating real wealth. And that's the question that's got to be put to the politicians.
Well, I did ask you about railway privatisation.
I'm so sorry,
Julian. I know you did.
No, it's perfectly okay to
generalise.
You
did answer, but before we get Martin's reply on that, we're going to hear a vox pop from Marina. She's been out on the streets asking you what you think about the railway privatisation.
Railway privatisation. Did it improve the service and did it improve the safety?
No, my family are old Great Western Railway people, and I think it was better when it was a nationalised railway, if they'd put more money into it. The nationalised railway needed more investment in rolling stock, new wagons and carriages to bring it up to standard, but I still think it should be a nationalised railway system.
What I used to do was I used to work for Sostrand, who do all the cycle paths and things like that. But the railway privatisation at the minute is silly. It's too expensive. I can fly home to Ireland cheaper than it is to get to, like, Manchester or somewhere. To get to Manchester is £86. That is ridiculous. If I want to go to visit my mother in Liverpool, it's going to cost me over £100.
I haven't really experienced it non-privatised. I've mostly travelled being a young person. But I'd say that the service is a bit questionable. I mean, I catch the train daily on a daily basis. And, for example, we're supposed to have 5 carriages every day. This is often down to 3 or 2. So it's very crowded and cramped. And I think we get treated worse than cattle, really. I mean, cattle have more rights than us for travelling around the country, and they just cram us onto the trains and no consideration for safety, really. Just get as many as possible on, really.
Well, safety shouldn't really be affected at all. My daughter didn't use the railway before it got privatised, because it was over 10, 20 years ago now. But competition, there is no competition between the railways. They got a monopoly for whichever route they own, and it's far too expensive.
Is competition between train operating companies a good thing?
Yes, I think so. So long as if they were clearer on their pricing and it made it easier for people to work out which company was more competitive than the others. At the moment, they're so confusing, you can't work out which one's the best.
I don't know who's doing the cheapest one. I don't use trains. I can't afford them. Pathetic. When you get on the train, you're not guaranteed a seat. You've got to stand, and you could be standing there the whole journey. It's wrong.
I guess if they're competing with each other, then perhaps they've got more incentive to up their game a bit and perhaps provide a better service, because they want to provide a better service than their competitors.
There is no competition between them. They own a monopoly.
What would make you want to use railways?
A lot cheaper travelling.
Cheaper fares and a seat you can actually get and sit in.
Cheaper prices.
Cheaper prices. You get on the train and pay a decent, normal, affordable price.
Well, to actually, rather than need to use the railways, like I currently have to use it, but to make me want to use the railways, it would have to be not so cramped conditions, a bit more clean, better ventilation. You're just relying on the windows for ventilations on a hot day. You need air conditioning, really, rather than being all stuffy. Definitely needs to be cheaper. Rail fares are going up constantly, it seems to be. You get on one day and it's one price, and then a couple of days later it seems to have gone up again. It's just ridiculous.
A lot cheaper, just far too expensive.
Well, I quite like that last lady there who was saying, talking about the idea of actually wanting to go on the train rather than being forced to go on the train, Martin.
Yes, well, I mean, I think in actual fact, all the evidence suggests that privatisation of the British Railways has been a ridiculous farrago of nonsense. There is no real competition, which is why they were all nationalised in the first place.
So what's the rationale behind it? Who's benefited?
Well, the shareholders we were talking earlier about. Who do you think owns these railway companies ultimately? It's the same people we were talking about earlier.
Well, HSBC owns lots, about something like 3/4 of the actual rolling stock.
In actual fact, of course, the subsidy to the non-profit making aspects of the railway has gone up by over 300% since we went private. So you have to actually subsidise a railway system. It doesn't actually function. It's an infrastructural good that you need to have if you want to make profit on your, you know, production side. But of course it's been treated, and this is the whole way that Britain works, is we treat the infrastructure as a profit making opportunity for sharks, which then raises the cost to industry, which means we're priced out of our export market, which is why we're up the creek without a paddle.
I agree with Martin on that one. Profit making opportunities for sharks, and it isn't just the railways. I think we've got to start looking at whether or not that's the motive for a lot of these privatisations across the country.
Well, these banks, don't they have the ability to sit there on a computer screen and press a few buttons and make up tens of thousands of pounds, even millions of pounds, then lend it out at interest. I mean, surely that in itself is just wrong, because they can then buy up as they have done, HSBC have done with the rolling stock companies. They've just bought up all this stuff by pressing buttons on a computer.
that was one of my points about the need in banking for there to be a much more fundamental review of the whole thing. And we've got to go back, take ourselves back to before Big Bang. We've got to dismantle what we've got at the moment and recast the die for the whole industry in a completely different way.
Okay.
Because this experiment that we've had over since 1985 hasn't worked.
Martin, finally, the we've got a system now where it's like the railways are becoming too expensive for many people to use. We've got a system whereby some of the basic infrastructure, including, as we're going to hear in a minute from Julian, the energy companies are just simply abusing their monopoly. They're abusing their position. But these are things that everybody, this is infrastructure that everybody needs to use.
When I was being taught economics in the late 70s, we were taught that free market capitalism was how Britain used to be run until World War II, but that was all old hat. And we were being encouraged, with our slightly left-wing sympathies, not to become communists or super-socialists, because in actual fact, capitalism had solved its problems. It used to be a boom-and-bust system run by sharks. But as a result of careful and judicious reform, we now had what we called a mixed economy, where the infrastructure was run for public benefit and private businesses who wanted to start up new starts and all the rest of it were given every encouragement. That's all out of the window, but it was in fact correct.
Why was it correct?
Because actual fact, living standards for ordinary people in Britain rose continuously through my childhood until I became an adult, and then it all went down the drain, and it's been down the drain ever since.
Okay, well, the final little bit of news before the news, if we can call it that. Prince Charles's public, he's a local lad, lives up in Tetbury. Prince Charles's public funding increases by 11.8% this year, and actually it was up 18% last year. So, Julian, what do you think of that?
Well, he's doing very well, isn't he? And there is a question of, you know, how much benefit the public get out of that. Let me actually say that I still believe in the royal family because of the positions they deny to others.
Okay.
But that's not down to the finances.
Coming up to the time for the Murdoch News at 6, we'll be speaking to Julian Parry, you just heard there again, after the news.
Community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk.